Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the dang show. Hey look, Strobe Talbot is on TV right now. On the Christian Amanpour Warmonger Hour. Funny too, New World Disorder is the headline, the caption beneath him. Of course, Strobe Talbot, as everyone knows, is the author of The Rise of the Global Nation in Time Magazine in, what, June or July? I guess July 1993, where he said that, yeah, well, you know, now that it's the Clinton era and everything, soon we'll have a one-world government that Russia and America will both answer to. Well, yeah, so how's that working out there, Mr. New World Disorder? Thank God you failed at your dastardly horrible plan. All right, well, what fun. Today on the show, Eric Margolies will be here, and he's going to say lots of smart stuff about lots of different smart things, or terrible things. And also Phil Giraldi, he is going to say lots of smart stuff about a lot of different terrible things. I think mostly not the same ones as Margolies, but there may be a little bit of overlap there, but don't worry, it'll be fine. And then, part 8 of our ongoing series with the great Gareth Porter, the great author of Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. That's right, you may have missed Part 7. Part 7 aired on my KPFK show, Anti-War Radio, which airs on Sunday mornings on 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. So you might have to go to scotthorton.org to catch up. In case you're a regular live listener of this show and you missed Episode 7 over the weekend. Well, anyway, you can skip one. That's what's a good thing about Gareth, is his book's real well done there, and it's a great book, and yet each chapter is a compelling standalone piece of work on its own. So it's okay if you miss one. You can still go back after today's show. But anyway, and you know what? I think maybe it's unprecedented. Gareth was joking that, you know, I don't know if anybody has ever demanded this before. This is probably a new record for interviewing the hell out of someone about a book that they wrote. Going chapter by chapter by chapter here. But I don't really have a boss. I mean, I guess Alan could fire my ass. My advertisers could all run away. But really, it seems to me as simple as, well, I want to interview Gareth Porter about everything in the book. So I think I will. Right? As long as he's happy to show up and do it, which he seems to be relatively happy to show up and do it. So right on then. Interview away. One thing that I would like to interview him about is what he knows about what was going on inside the CIA over all these years of all their false accusations against Iran. Guess what? That's the chapter that I just read this morning, and I'm going to interview him about today. I always wondered about that. What is the story behind the NIE of 2007? What's the story behind the NIE of 2005? I think we already know the story behind 03. But anyway, 01. Yeah. No, it's really important. And I want to know all of the details. You know, a big part of how I got stuck this way, I may have told you this one time before years ago, if you've been listening that long. I got in an argument about Waco and lost. And it wasn't because I was wrong. It was just because the guy that I was arguing with, man, he had the government's case memorized to the tiniest detail. I don't think he was a cop either. He was just some right-winger, and maybe his dad was a cop or something. And man, this guy just believed the hell out of every lie that they said about the Davidians and what happened there at that thing. And he beat me. Like, in front of people, I lost the argument. And, of course, I was right that those people were not criminals and that the government was responsible for every horrible thing that happened there, including machine gunning all the people to death and burning them on the last day there. But anyway, the point is I lost the argument because I couldn't prove it. And so then, you know what I did? I read a bunch of books about it. And then, you know what happened after that? I never lost an argument about Waco ever again. But you know what else happened? Is I learned that I really can't do this. Go ahead and give me some pages. I'll read them, and then I'll whoop the ass of whoever's bad on anything. And since I'm always siding with the underdog against power, fine. It doesn't even matter if I'm a real jerk, because I'm on the side of the underdog against power. So, that's it. So, try to fight with me about Waco or anything else, I'll thrash you. And so, Iran, that's another one. It's not good enough for me to say, well, I don't believe whatever your accusation is. I want to be able to refute it. So, Gareth Porter. Now, what could possibly be better? How could I possibly be luckier? I mean, whatever, I tried and made it this way on purpose and everything. But still, I consider myself very lucky that I have access to Gareth Porter. I don't just get to read his great Iran book like you guys all can. I get to ask him basically an unlimited number of questions about what it is I read and give him a chance to say it all out loud where you guys can hear it. That's really cool. That helps me master the subject matter myself. And I've learned so much. And man, you know me. Hell, probably a lot of you can't hear me anymore because you quit listening because you just couldn't stand all the coverage of Iran's nuclear program anymore. I've been especially talking with Gareth Porter about this stuff for 5 years. But a lot of other people before then and since then too. And man, I've learned so many things reading Gareth's book. I hope that, you know, a fairly high percentage of it sticks in my brain where I can get to it later. I don't think I'll have to read it twice. But man, it's so good. I think maybe what you should do is buy a copy and read it. It's called Manufactured Crisis: The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. And you know, if you're part of some organization or another, bowling league, church, punk rock band, whoever you are, whatever it is that you do, especially if you're in some kind of politics or you're around some kind of institute or think tank or any kind of thing, why not buy a giant box full and pass them around? What if you work at the United Nations building? Don't you think people at the United Nations building ought to be able to stumble across copies of Gareth Porter's book every time they turn around, if that was the kind of thing that they were interested in stumbling across? Don't you think all of your foreign policy studies professors at your local university ought to have a chance to know that Gareth Porter wrote a book debunking all of this crap? So here, read it. It's one of those things. This is why I do radio, so I can tell you guys to read Gareth Porter. That's it. If everybody would just read Gareth Porter, then they'd all be, you know, almost as good as me on Iran nuclear issues, and then we'd live in a happier world. Maybe. You try. You see what happens, you know, and do what you can. I guess it's possible that the end of the Cold War with Iran will lead to some kind of horrible realignment of powers in the Middle East, and then America will end up at war with our allies, the Saudis, or some kind of horrible thing. Who knows what kind of things can happen in the world? You never really know. But do the right thing based on, you know, peace and honesty and that kind of stuff in the first place, and chances are pretty good that you'd be all right. Certainly the opposite is true, as Alan Bock taught me, paraphrasing Aldous Huxley, that violent and destructive means determine violent and destructive ends. So, since we know that those aren't the right options, at least to turn to at first, how about compromise? How about you guys have a nuclear program, and we'll stop threatening you and lift all our sanctions? That seems like a good compromise to me. And I guess, you know, it would be nice if they signed the additional protocol, their safeguards agreement, but I don't really care about that. Hell, I don't really care if Iran bought a bunch of hydrogen bombs from the Russians. Not that they'd be for sale, but the hell do I care? If anything, it would probably make them a more responsible power. Yeah, who knows? I mean, I'm against nukes and everything, but I'm just not for the American nuclear weapons state forbidding the others from getting them, that's all. They're really bad at it. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Hey, y'all, how's things? Welcome back from the commercial break. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. All right, now real quick. So, yeah, they're saying that the plane, the big missing plane, is in the ocean somewhere. I know, you're shocked, right? Yeah, it's in the ocean. That's why they can't find us, because there's an ocean on top of it. It's at the bottom of the ocean. But they did some satellite analysis from the satellite phone company. And they got their pings straight, and they figured it out more or less where it crashed. Which made the guy that wrote the thing, I guess it was in the New Yorker, right? Seem like the most accurate. They went and turned, probably, went and turned to try to make it to the nearest airport. But the smoke got to them before they could get there. So then they're just on autopilot till the damn thing fell out of the sky. Which it finally did when it ran out of gas. So that's why the hell it's way in the southern Indian Ocean. Occam's razor kind of a thing. I saw Trita Parsi tweet the other day, CNN, go home, you're drunk. Because CNN was speculating, well, maybe some hijackers hijacked the plane and flew it to Iran and they're preparing to do a kamikaze attack on Israel. Would you shut up? Give me a break. Give us all a break for a minute, okay, with Israel's pretended victimhood, okay? Making me sick to my stomach. I can't take it anymore. Oh, maybe the missing plane is on its way here. Certainly wouldn't be your cowardice that annoys everybody about you so much. It must be something else. All right. And anyway, you know, it's a shame this plane fell out of the sky. It wasn't even JetBlue. You would think that, oh, was it a JetBlue flight? Because those things are dangerous, man. You ever listen to the sounds that a JetBlue plane makes? You know, that's if you landed right side up. And then damn things. I feel sorry for them because I think people are all just assuming that, oh, it must have been a JetBlue flight that fell out of the sky. Because you know how they are. Those guys suck, man. You're taking your life in your hands and in some goon's hands when you ride with JetBlue. Everybody just blames them for no reason. It wasn't even their fault this time. I mean, sure, a lot of things about them are horrible, but not this particular crash. So, you know, it's understandable why people would leap to that conclusion that it must have been a JetBlue thing. But no, in this case, it was Malaysian Airlines. Not that I'm recommending you ride JetBlue, because they do fall out of the sky from time to time. Only usually they just smash and explode on the ground. Instead of being buried in the bottom of the sea. But, you know, take your pick. But anyway, so the whole thing's a tragedy. I'm sorry. I don't mean to make fun of the whole damn thing. It's horrible. Just, you know what it is. Of course, you know what it is. It's that the media has turned this thing into a freaking joke by now. CNN has made CNN the center of the story. As everybody's been laughing at them endlessly, going on and on about what they don't know for 2 weeks. 3 weeks, almost. And so, the story's not even about all the dead people and their family anymore. The story is about CNN. And would you get a load of these guys? Make that money, guys, I guess. How do you get people who don't care about the news to watch the news? Missing plane story. So, they just took that to its logical conclusion. To its least common denominator. And it's pretty pathetic, but anyway. So, all right, and then let's see. We're going to talk about that with Margulies, and we're going to talk about that with Giraldi. We're going to talk about that with Margulies, and that with Margulies. And then, nah, who cares about that? Here's something that's really important. Higher jobless rates for Iraq-Afghan vets. Well, so, you know, I don't know. I'm not, like, trying to rub anybody's face in it or anything like that. I'm just, let there be fair warning that those commercials on TV are actually dishonest. I mean, they could describe you or someone you know. Don't tell me, nuh-uh, because my cousin got a good job or something, because I'm not saying it's impossible. But I'm just saying, generally speaking, TV commercials and military recruiters, they don't try to sell you on the you know, glory of fighting for George Bush or Barack Obama or the greatness or the righteousness of their cause either, because nobody believes in that crap anymore. They ever did. The focus always is on how this can be money for college for you. This could be training in a technical profession that you could make some high blue-collar dollars, you know, high-end of blue-collar work, or even better. You know, maybe you could be a computer programmer. Maybe, like on the TV commercials, if you're black or Hispanic, we all know that because of the military's destruction of our economy, you have even less opportunity than everybody else in a horrible recession. But there's only one way for you to escape that. The cause of and solution to all of America's problems, militarism. And so if you're black or Hispanic, you definitely ought to join the military. Only then could you be a helicopter repairman. Only then could you get a job as a firefighter. Remember that? Where were all the politically incorrect, or I mean, political correctness groups crying over that one? Where they're like, you know, hey, N-word, you think you could get a job as a firefighter? Yeah, right. Maybe if you join the army first. Like, what? Really? You guys are despicable, man. And, I mean, wasn't that the exact words of the commercial? I'm pretty sure I quoted exactly. Hey, you, insert slur for Mexican here. It's not like anybody's ever going to give you a job being a helicopter mechanic. Give me a break. I mean, unless maybe you join the Army first or the Air Force. Then you could be a helicopter mechanic, they promise. And anyway, and just think of the entire focus of all of their slogans. Aim high, right? Not roll back communism. Aim high. Army of one. And get, you know, do more before 5 a.m. than most people do all day and whatever, whatever. All of the slogans, money for college more than anything. All the slogans are about self-improvement for you. How a boy becomes a man. How a poor kid can become working class. How a working class kid might be able to become a non-commissioned officer. And therefore, you know, a high-level blue-collar worker at some point or something. You know, a technician or repairman. That kind of thing. How a shiftless young rich kid can grow up to, you know, take life seriously and make his family proud. And, you know, be an officer, get an advanced degree. Man, we're brought up with this. You know, I'm sorry I'm not that eloquent, but I know all this stuff wrote because I'm from here, too. You know, and my parents, they're not really militarist types or anything like that. And thank goodness they weren't pro-Reagan when I was a little kid. I might have grown up all screwed up in the, you know, Reagan-Bush era or something. That would have been horrible. But so it's never been a centerpiece, you know, in my family life necessarily, but it's absolutely inescapable. Of course, in the Terror War years, much more so probably even than the brinksmanship of the Ronald Reagan years and the reigniting of the arms race in the Cold War after Nixonian detente and all that. But it's just, you know, it's a major rite of passage. That's what we're taught. And, you know, it's just like with the lies about Ukraine. Most of it's by omission. It's the same thing here. You know, this is why you have to swear to tell the whole truth in court, because just a piece of the truth can be terribly misleading. You have to tell the whole truth. Get to the real point of it, you know? And so they always just leave out the sacrifice. They always just leave out, of course, you're not going to see your son for the first few years of his life if you come home to him at all. Or by the time you get home, your wife won't be your wife anymore. She'll be your old best friend's new girl. I mean, that kind of thing happens a lot. And they don't tell you that actually, if you're a veteran of these wars that they send you off to, you have a higher jobless rate than other veterans or the nation at large. I mean, I know from my childhood that virtually every bum on the side of the road, and I'm not that politically correct, homeless citizen or whatever you're supposed to call them, every bum had a Vietnam War army jacket on. And maybe some of them were just hippies in an army jacket, but no, I'm pretty sure it was the Vietnam War that had destroyed these men. And not everybody who went to Vietnam was destroyed by it, but a lot of them were. And, you know, not that anybody on the side of the road is destroyed necessarily, but they sure didn't have what it took to take care of themselves. And throwing themselves on the mercy of strangers to help them even survive. And I don't know if you remember, I don't know how old you are, I don't know your context, but for me, I still remember well the giant lie by omission of 2002. The unstated assumption under all the arguing us into war in Iraq, and that was that this is going to be fine. George Bush and the Republicans, man, they love the veterans. They never let anything bad happen to the veterans. They're going to take good care of them. And anything about, you know, all the homeless being Vietnam vets on the side of the road, you know, all the homeless you see on the side of the road being Vietnam vets, where that just has nothing to do with this, right? That era is just might as well have been back before Korea. Never happened, doesn't matter. It's not going to be like that this time. In fact, one of my old best friends from childhood, the last words I ever heard from him was, "You don't know what you're talking about. George Bush is doing a lot of really good things for us right now," as he was getting ready to go off to war in Afghanistan, or, well, I guess Iraq. But, of course, that's not the case. And it's not the case that the military is the way to get ahead in this society. It never was.
Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here. Don't you want a bust of Murray Rothbard for your desk at work? A Ludwig von Mises for your bookshelf at home? A Harry Brown, a Ron Paul as a gift for a friend? Check out these awesome busts of your libertarian heroes at myheroesthink.com. They come in 6 or 9 inch sizes and now in color, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf in my office and I love it. Just click the banner ad in the right margin at scotthorton.org and enter promo code ScottHortonShow to save $5. That's myheroesthink.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. The website is scotthorton.org. You can tweet me at ScottHortonShow if you like tweeting things. All right, our first guest on the show today is our good friend Eric Margolies, author of War at the Top of the World and American Raj, Liberation or Domination. And, of course, he writes at his own website, ericmargolies.com, spell it like Margolis, and also at lewrockwell.com and at unz.com, U-N-Z, unz.com. Welcome back to the show, Eric. How are you doing?
Thank you, Scott. I'm elated to be back with you, as always.
All right, good times. Well, there's a bunch of horrible things going on in the world, and I wonder what you think about them. First of all, apparently, the military junta in charge of Egypt right now, again, has apparently sentenced 528 convicted supporters of Mohamed Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood to death. Are they all guilty of treason? What's the big deal? What's going to happen?
Well, what we're seeing in Egypt is an absolutely disgusting and hideous example of military junta fascism, but with an Egyptian brutal, sadistic Egyptian twist that is completely out of character with the normally easygoing Egyptians. Having lived in Egypt and covered the Middle East for decades, I'm appalled at what I see. These people are charged with treason and sedition and murder, and after a one-day trial, just one day, and I expect many of the cases will be reduced sentences, and they won't all be shot. But it's a sign of the vindictiveness and the efforts by the military junta, which receives our aid money, to terrorize the Egyptian population into quiescence and to stamp the life out of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is, after all, a non-violent nationalist political movement.
Hey, does it hurt your side from laughing when you hear the current government blame America for being behind the Muslim Brotherhood and all their attempts to maintain any power?
A lot of Egyptians believe that, particularly we're talking the right wing in Egypt, the well-to-do urban elite, Egypt's Christians, who've taken a very wrong-headed approach to this project, to this problem. They somehow, because the U.S. sought properly to maintain links or open links to the Muslim Brotherhood, so it would have some influence. After all, they were the first democratically elected government in Egyptian history. They're now blaming the U.S. for having done this, and that's wrong. Just as wrong, the supreme leader of Al-Azhar University, which is like almost like the Vatican of the Muslim world, actually came out and backed the death sentence against these 528 or 29 people of the Muslim Brotherhood, and he's been fulminating against them too. Another government yes man. Mm-hmm.
But then, contrarily, I believe, as you told me before, at least your perspective was that Mohamed Morsi and al-Sisi, the new military dictator, and his entire military dictatorship, the former government of Mubarak, that they worked with the Americans in coming back to power in the very first place. So it's really they're just, projecting and accusing the Muslim Brotherhood of being the treasonous sock puppets of the Americans, when really it's them, just like it always has been, the Mubarakists.
How ironic. The al-Sisi military junta, which Secretary of State John Kerry described as a democratic government led by this little tin-pot popinjay field marshal, no less, al-Sisi, who's a desk general, never fired a shot in anger in his life, except at his own people. They are receiving, still receiving, I think it's $1.2 million, billion dollars a year in U.S. aid. We cut back on some military aid for a bit because al-Sisi's repression became too extreme even for Washington's hawks, but it will shortly be restored, and we are going to become one of the primary supporters of Egypt, certainly after Saudi Arabia, that other enlightened democracy.
Yeah. Well, you said that they won't all be shot, this 528, but what percentage of them will be, and what percentage of them will be tortured and then set free to become the next generation Zawahiri?
Well, I think they'll probably all be pardoned. Or not pardoned, but they'll have their sentences reduced to a mere 20 years breaking rocks in the desert or something. And this is to warn the rest of the Muslim Brotherhood, which was, after all, Egypt's most popular party, to get lost or else. I don't even think this little dictator al-Sisi has the chutzpah to go and execute all these people. It would put him, Washington, in a very embarrassing spot.
Well, was there any intelligence behind his decision to do it this way, or he's just got excited and now he's going to have to climb down?
No, this is a kind of a 1930s Stalinist purge that's going on in Egypt. Anybody associated with the Muslim Brotherhood, any independents in politics, any religious figures, journalists, you know, there are a whole bunch of journalists from Al Jazeera who are in prison mm-hmm. in Egypt, and they're going to be tried as God knows what, spies or traitors or something like that. So it's just mass intimidation. It's really, it's state-sponsored terrorism.
Well, now, and so what about the consequences of this for the future? Because I can't help but think of, well, first of all, you know, like I mentioned, Zawahiri there, his story was that he knew a guy who knew a guy who was involved in the assassination of Anwar Sadat, so he got tortured, and that was what turned him from Zawahiri the surgeon into Zawahiri the mad bomber, and how, you know, that's the kind of thing that seems to play out over and over again. But then also, there's the idea that he's been pushing, really, that's his whole criticism all along for years and years of the Muslim Brotherhood, is that you guys are suckers playing into the Western game and trying to run for office and participate in democracy and all this crap, like Mubarak is ever going to really let you participate in the government there. If you ever did win, they'd cancel your election results anyway and all of that. And it seems like, you know, it's almost like Frank Gaffney and them are right, that Obama's some Islamist just trying to prove these Al-Qaeda guys right about us, because they just follow his script no matter what.
Well, it's not what President Obama is doing. It's what the junta in Egypt is doing, and in Saudi Arabia and in Jordan. We're seeing ferocious repression going on in the Middle East. You know, Egypt always used to be, in the last 30 years, used to be a brutal dictatorship. But we Americans didn't want to see it because it was a very important ally. Instead, we'd read women's fashion magazines gushing about Mrs. Mubarak's wife and stuff like that. But it was a brutal place. As I saw, people were tortured. Men who stepped out of line were gang raped in the prisons. People were hanged and tortured with electricity. Now it's gotten even worse. Just when we thought nothing could get worse or more brutal in Egypt, backed by billions of dollars of U.S. tax money, it has now happened. What's going to happen next? There's got to be a spreading popular armed uprising against the military junta. It's unlikely that it's just going to go on the way it is, intimidating people. And the U.S. will come back and support it.
The Mujahideen or the dictators, they can't seem to decide.
It's hard because we have our own renta Mujahideens now that we are sending to Syria. And some of these guys are Egyptians. And we don't know who we're supporting in this weird sort of house of mirrors in the Middle East.
Well, I think we talked about before how the you know, the people on the outs here, the Muslim Brotherhood, and especially their younger, angrier allies in Egypt, how they don't really have that much access to weapons. It's not like Iraq, where every house already had an AK, and then plus all his Saddam's arms depots were left wide open for 3 or 4 years by Donald Rumsfeld to be looted for every last bit of explosives and everything to be used in the insurgency. So there's always kind of a question about what ability they might have to wage an insurgency there. But then I guess it's sort of obvious, isn't it? That's where the question of Muammar Gaddafi's old weapons stores comes into play. And whether do you think it's possible that a real insurgency could be waged in Egypt with maybe with some of Gaddafi's arms?
And defectors from the Egyptian army. The army itself is not monolithic, particularly in the lower ranks. It comes from the people. And as the repression gets worse and worse, I would think that certain there will be units or individuals in the army who will break away. There is a lot of there's some fighting going on in the Sinai Desert, which nobody really understands what's right. behind it. But there have been attacks on Egyptian troop units of police. The Sinai Bedouin fighters are getting to be a bigger problem. The Egyptians, who are now in cahoots with the Israelis to try and stamp them out.
And now, is it presumed that these guys are bin Ladenite Salafists or they're some other sect?
We don't really know. They're just a bunch of angry guys who've got some weapons.
Yeah. And, plenty to be angry about, no matter who you are living in the Sinai, I guess.
You know, and this is superimposed on top of Egypt's grave everyday problems that have nothing to do with politics. They can't feed themselves in Egypt. There's hideous overcrowding in a country of 80 million people, which is really has got room for about 5 million. There's no education. There's sewage everywhere. People are sick. It's just an awful situation. Cairo is an urban nightmare. So, and the problem with Egypt, their basic problem is that Egypt can't feed itself. It has to import food. And that most of that food was wheat coming from the United States, authorized by the U.S. Congress. And if the Egyptians ever looked the wrong way at the Israelis would call up Congress and say, put the squeeze on the Egyptians, threaten to cut off their aid, and there'll be no food for Egypt tomorrow. So Egypt, inadvertently, because of the Camp David Accords, Egypt fell under the thumb of the Israelis to a large extent, which explains why Egypt, even today, is selling gas, natural gas, below market cost to the Israelis.
Yeah, while their own people are going hungry. Now, is there precedent for the threat of interrupting the wheat supply? Or everybody just knows that they could?
Oh, they know that they could. I don't think it's been overtly stated yet.
Yeah, but you didn't make that up either. I mean, this is something that people have talked about in the past.
Oh, I've been writing about that for years. It's in my book, American Raj, one of the main points that I make.
Yeah, it's something that you taught me right after the Arab Spring, that's for sure. All right, hold it right there, everybody. It's Eric Margulies, ericmargulies.com, lewrockwell.com, uns.com. We'll be right back after this. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. offnow.org. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your bitcoin address, and you get your bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. All right, you guys, welcome back. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm him. You can see why it's called that and everything. All right, talking with Eric Margulies, author of American Raj, Liberation or Domination, and a whole hell of a lot of essays, too, at ericmargulies.com, lewrockwell.com, uns.com. And I guess if we could... Eric, I'd like to talk with you now about this article, the latest one for lewrockwell.com. Will Israel join the war in Syria? Oh, man. I guess I'll just turn it over to you. Will Israel join the war in Syria, Eric?
kind of almost a rhetorical question, Scott, because Israel has been quietly supporting this war and has gotten its American supporters to be pushing very hard for the U.S. to attack Syria and to sustain this effort to overthrow the Assad regime in Syria. Israel has its own reasons for doing this, not necessarily the same as America's. But now the Israelis, well, the point of my, one of the points was that beside this covert backing of the war in Syria, Israel is now increasingly intervening militarily. And there's a possibility that now that the Assad forces are winning and the U.S.-backed forces are being beaten. The key factor here is Assad's armor and air force, and the Israelis may intervene to destroy them, just as America was planning to do with this phony business over the chemical weapons. Israel may now do it because Israel has decided, after much internal debate, that they would like to overthrow Assad.
Well, they must be crazy, I guess. Well, and they bombed Syria last week, whatever. But okay, now, I don't know. I'm sorry, because I'm always trying to put myself in these other people's shoes, and I know that it's a false premise to approach these things rationally or from a national interest point of view, when really it's an individual public choice theory type of point of view about how all these policies are made and everything. However, Eric, there's got to be people in the Israeli government, in their military, in their intelligence services, maybe on their cabinet, in the prime minister's office somewhere, somebody saying, guys, without Assad, Al-Qaeda win. Suicide bomber, crazy Takfiri madmen win. And okay, so maybe they won't be able to maintain a military force as powerful as Assad has maintained on their northern border. But still, is that actually going to be an improvement over the current situation? What Israeli strategist, thinking even more than 2 weeks out, could possibly be for this? Could possibly prefer chaos and not just, you know, David Wurmser's imagination in 1996 about what it might look like or something, but post-Iraq war ideas of what it will look like when, you know, all of Syria is just the Anbar province for the next 6 years or whatever it is. They've got to be crazy. I don't understand it. I'm sorry for going on. I don't get it.
Israel has had a policy of very successfully destroying all military threats from the Arab states. Egypt has been gelded under al-Sisi. Its army is only used for internal suppression. Libya is kaput. Iraq, the other main danger, has been crushed into rubble. Syria is the last Arab state that has any credible military challenge to Israel, even though its military is 1960s vintage. But if Assad is overthrown, this will mark the end of any organized military threat from Syria. But equally important, it will end any challenge to Israel's ongoing annexation of the Golan Heights, Syria's Golan Heights, which Israel seized in 1967, which is a very important water source to Israel. You know, Washington screaming about Russian annexation of Crimea. Mm. Well, what about Israeli annexation of the Golan Heights? We don't have a peep from Washington or Congress about that.
But they already own the Golan Heights, right?
Well, I mean, it was annexed in the 80s, and they have settlers there and very important military bases. Extremely important. Israeli artillery on the Golan Heights can actually hit Damascus. That's how close it is.
Well, I mean, but this is my point, though, is that Assad, and listen, I'm not the world's greatest expert on Levantine politics, but I was always under the impression that he was as quiet as a mouse about the Golan Heights.
He was.
That he might as well have been working for Mossad. He was so polite up there on their northern border.
He was. He was hand in glove with the Israelis, like many of the Arab leaders, not as much as Jordan, but certainly he was very correct, as the Germans would say, with Israel.
Not a sock puppet, but not a problem.
No, he made no trouble. The border between Israel and Syria was totally quiet. Assad worked with the West. He tortured people for us. He kept a lid on things. He kept a lid on all the Arab wild men jihadists. We should really be allied with Assad. That's the crazy thing. And not allied with the people who are opposing it. But anyway, but the Israelis have been torn by this. Like, even under Dick Cheney and Bush, there was talk, the Israelis were talking about invading Syria and Lebanon and wiping out Hezbollah and overthrowing the Assad regime. The Israelis know they'll be cast, and they've been through the Lebanese experience with 15 years of civil war, but Israel doesn't have to occupy Syria. All it needs to do is what it's doing now, just sit across the border, hold the Golan Heights, watch the Syrians shoot each other, keep that war going, and laugh.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, don't get me wrong. I can totally see the whole clean break, Yanan plan type strategy, like you're saying. Just make sure that there is no actual modern nation state in the Middle East. I mean, other than Egypt and Jordan, I guess, as long as they're compliant enough. But like you're saying, things can be done about that, too. But it still seems to me, though, that after the experience of the Iraq War and after the experience of the last few years of looking at who's doing the killing of who up there in Syria, that, well, like you're saying, from the point of view of national interest goes and all that, all things being equal, we ought to be friends with Assad and not with the jihadists. I mean, that is a real, isn't it, a real security threat to Israel, much more than Assad could ever be to Israel for the future? I mean, I saw where Michael Oren said, well, listen, Hezbollah is backed by Iran, and so forget it. We always will prefer Al-Qaeda to them. But really, because it seems to me like Al-Qaeda can't be reasoned with like Nasrallah can be reasoned with.
You know, it's a very minor pipsqueak threat. Even Hezbollah, with all its alleged rockets, and certainly Hamas and Al-Qaeda and all that, these are pinprick threats to the Israelis. They're so strong. The Israelis could take over the entire Middle East in about 2 weeks. If they wanted to, then they'd really be in trouble holding territory. But Israel has itself hermetically sealed from the rest of the Arab world with minefields and wires and electronic stuff and anti-aircraft, anti-missile missiles, and it's very well protected. It doesn't have to worry very much. It can survive any kind of pinprick attacks that can be delivered against it.
Yeah. All right. Well, that makes sense. I mean, hell, even with September 11th, it's not like that was an actual threat to America in a real military threat sense. You know, not like if the EU brought their navy together against us or some kind of thing, you know.
That's right.
All right. And now, so I'm sorry. In just the last couple of minutes here, they're going back to Uganda and hunting for Kony 2012 over there. What?
What a weird story is that?
I mean, you buying that? What is this? No. Are they really going after this guy, Kony, or it's all just cover for keeping the Chinese out, or what?
Yeah, Kony, this guy is something called the Lord's Army. He's some kind of Bush fanatic, and who went from stealing chickens to stealing kids, and he's in the bush in the middle of nowhere. Uganda has become an American protectorate. Its dictatorial ruler, Museveni, is one of Washington's key men in East Africa. In fact, Ugandan troops just entered action into South Sudan to support American interests. We use the Ugandan troops, mercenary troops, are used in Somalia to fight Shabab. So it's a very useful base for us. And I don't know, this Lord's Army business is weird. We're sending four aircraft and 250 American troops to supplement another 150 American Rangers, who are the special forces who are supposed to be there running around the bush and possibly going into other neighboring countries. It is certainly a clear sign of the growing American involvement in East Africa, an area that is supposed to have considerable oil. Where there's oil, there are Americans.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it just seems like, and I'm completely just imagining this, but they're really there to establish a base, right? This doesn't have anything to do with that Kony guy.
Oh,
the longer he's on the run, the better for that, from their point of view, right?
that's like Uganda sending troops to America to allegedly to run over and arrest Reverend, I don't know, Jerry Falwell or somebody like Pat Robertson. It's weird. More important is that beside Uganda, we have now South Sudan, which we engineered the breakaway from the state of Sudan. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to we've set up a puppet government in Somalia, and this whole area is becoming a new major interest of the U.S. strategy.
Yeah. Boy, and people are dying terribly, too. I mean, I don't know what's the latest from South Sudan, but I know the two South Sudanese tribes, once they got their independence, they turn on each other, and that's another mess we'll have to cover another time. Thanks very much for your time, as always, Eric. Appreciate it.
Cheers, Scott.
EricMargulies.com, everybody, and LouRockwell.com for Eric Margulies. The book is American Raj. We'll be right back. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. Boy, the idiocy that passes by my eyeballs on these screens all day. It's really a miracle I can sort it all out at all. All right. Well, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. Our next guest is Phil Giraldi. He is formerly a CIA officer and DIA officer, and now he is editor, contributor, this, that, the other thing, writer for Antiwar.com, the American Conservative Magazine, as well as Uns.com. Well, pretty much just like Eric Margulies. And then... Also, he's the executive director of the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Welcome back to the show, Phil. How are you doing?
I'm fine, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing good. Appreciate you joining us today. Put on any good conferences lately?
Well, we had one a couple of weeks ago that you attended and spoke at, you know, about reevaluating the Israeli-United States special relationship. I think it was a pretty big success. We had a packed house of over 350 people at the National Press Club, and it was actually on C-SPAN Live, which is a first.
Yeah, that was a really big deal, and... I would definitely say a great success. And now, so tell me this, where might people be able to go and see the footage and or hear the audio from this great conference and all the great speeches that were given there?
Well, we're gradually putting them up on the website. It's at natsummit.org. Most of them are up. In fact, all the speeches are up in terms of audio. We have transcripts of nearly all the speeches. If you go to the bios of the 24 speakers, you'll see transcripts of the speeches that they gave. And it's all pretty much there. It should all be completely there in the next day or two.
And there's some really good speeches in there. I mean, all of them were pretty good, but some of them were absolutely great and definitely worth people's time to go and take a look. Again, it was the National Summit to Reassess the American-Israel Special Relationship. It's at natsummit.org, and I think you watched the video on C-SPAN, too. C-SPAN.org, I think they still have it there.
Yeah, it's available on C-SPAN. You might have to search a little bit for it, but it's there.
Yeah, it's on there. All right, good deal. Now, I want to start with something that you said on the phone earlier when I was calling you to see if you could do the show today, and that was that you were talking with a mutual friend of ours who's been going to some kind of conservative meetings around Washington, D.C., and he's been learning some terrifying things. Like what?
Yeah, well, this is a good friend of mine, and you know him too, who's a longtime traditional conservative, and he attends all these weekly gatherings that conservative groups like Grover Norquist and others have, and he says it's absolutely frightening what's going on. He says that it's the bloodlust that seems to be currently out and visible and audible over confronting Russia is astonishing. And he says that in some ways he almost thinks it's worse than it was before Iraq.
Now, I got to wonder about that because, you know, when I think back to 2001, 2002, and early 2003 in that era, and the not just lying us into war, but intimidating us into war, Sure seems like Washington, D.C., they were either gung-ho fully on board, or they were at least intimidated first among all of us in the whole country. I can't imagine the pressure that somebody like Grover Norquist was under. I know he's much more fiscal conservative than any kind of imperialist ideologue. And I don't know if he was really for Iraq or not, but I'm sure that he didn't have much choice in supporting it at the time, you know?
Yeah, well, Grover actually was not supportive of the Iraq War, and he takes fairly moderate positions on many foreign policy issues. But I think what my friend is saying is that he's astonished by the level of this anger that seems to be surfacing. Recollections of what it was like back in 2003. It was a lot different. In fact, this friend of mine and I, for the only time in our lives, marched at peace demonstrations in Washington. So it was a different. There's no question about it. But I think what's really surprised him is just, you know, why this issue has caught fire. I mean, why are all the leading newspapers calling for aggressive steps against Russia? Why are all of the talking heads? Well, you know, we expect that. Why the politicians are all on board of this? I mean, it's just that it makes no sense. We have no reason to be doing this. We don't have to approve of what Russia does. We don't have to approve of Putin. But the fact is that it's a sovereign country, and what it's doing, it has plausible reasons to be doing. And the fact that we want to get involved in the middle of this is just insanity.
Yeah, it's funny because it seems like, well, I don't know. I mean, I guess I'll ask you, you know, what you think all the different incentives are. It seems to me like one incentive that ought to be in play would be, especially among some of these older, you know, maybe former secretaries of state and things like that, that they could play cool gray beard, easy there, tiger, cooler heads prevail type of a role in this thing. You know, maybe a Baker, a Scowcroft, or somebody. I guess Kissinger wrote something about everybody calm down a little bit. But for the most part, it seems like there's been very little of that. And I guess I don't understand why not. It seems like there would be at least some of these people would think that's the reputation that they want for their own future, that they're the wise man for later on, you know, after Brzezinski dies or whatever.
Yeah, well, the funny thing is a lot of this agitation is coming from Democrats. It's coming from, there was a piece in the Washington Post 2 days ago by Madeleine Albright calling for aggressive steps. There was Sandy Berger about 2 weeks ago had a similar piece. I mean, if there ever was a failed foreign policy, it was under Bill Clinton, and which we've unfortunately continued ever since then. But the fact is, you know, he started all this stuff, and so they're calling for, you know, confronting Russia, and of course we have the progressive interventionists that are in the administration right now, Susan Rice. You know, it's these people, and I'm just doing a little research on the ambassador who just left, the U.S. ambassador who just left Russia, Mick Fall. And this guy was a democracy promoter put in as ambassador to Moscow. I mean, what kind of sense does this stuff make?
Yeah, well, it's not like they have any H-bombs anymore, right? Or do they?
Only about 800 of them.
I mean, it's not like America would use nukes if the Russians were busily working to overthrow our government, and they put our government's back up against the wall, a situation like that, right?
Yeah, right, yeah. I mean, we're the only nation in history to use nukes.
Yeah, I mean, I can see the mushroom clouds now. I can feel the heat from them.
Yep.
All right, now, now here's the thing about it. It seems like, you know, for Berger and Albright, for example, that you mentioned there, the Clintonites who really, you know, pushed this expand NATO policy for whatever reasons, is it now that they just can't admit that, well, geez, if this is a problem, then that means I got us into it, and I can't admit that, so I gotta just double down? Is it that obvious and that simple?
Well, to me, I mean, being an adult about these issues, if you make a mistake, and in retrospect it was a mistake, you admit it. But you're right. I mean, our ruling class in this country can never admit that it's made a mistake. I mean, how few of the people who pushed for the Iraq War, for example, have said it was a mistake? I think you can count them on the two fingers of one hand. And that's about it. And it's just absolutely amazing that this these terrible policies continue, and the people who coined the policies or are the architects of the policies can never seemingly admit that they did something wrong. I mean, it's just you even go back to the Balkans and everything, how screwed up that was, and bombing Serbia and everything. None of these policies were thought through to the point that they made any sense, and they don't make any sense now.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I'll contradict myself, too, about the consensus, because at least, well, no, I mean, it's still right. It's the exceptions that prove the rule, but they're pretty powerful exceptions in the media lately. I'm thinking of Jack Matlock, the former ambassador of the USSR, who wrote in the Washington Post and was on this show, as well as Leslie Gelb, who is a former president of the Council on Foreign Relations and helped Dan Ellsberg write the Pentagon Papers back when, and is a very influential sort of mini Brzezinski type among the Democrats, as best I can tell. And then, of course, Paul Pillar has written some stuff like this, former leader at the National Intelligence Council there, saying, hey, guys, let's at least tell the truth about what's going on here. Whoa. We don't want to have our relationship with Russia based on policies that really are based on the narrative that we're saying on TV here, right? And there's supposed to be a difference between lying and believing your own lie. And when it comes to our relationship with Russia, we can't afford to be dishonest about what happened here. We sort of kind of picked this fight, okay? That kind of thing. So I don't know if that's really getting through, but it's sort of, in fact, it probably isn't, and it's a measure of how desperate somebody like Leslie Gelb would be to write something like that, to say, hey, guys, come on, can we please get back to basing our discussion of what to do on the real facts of the matter instead of just what we're telling the rubes, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's crazy. All right, well, I'm sorry, I talked us all the way to the damn break. Now, we're talking with Phil Giraldi from the Council for the National Interest and Antiwar.com and the American Conservative and all that. We'll be back in just a sec. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all the stocks while the getting is good, investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the war state. Available at scotthorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And we got Phil Giraldi on the line here. He writes for the American Conservative Magazine and Antiwar.com. And uns.com. They run a lot of great stuff over there at uns.com. And I guess I'll go ahead and ask you about this now because I want to get back to Ukraine in a second. Well, no, let's do Ukraine and then I'll ask you about this. Uns, I'm writing a note to myself here. Ukraine. So there's a lot of things about Ukraine worth discussing, but one thing that I wonder whether you saw this and what you think it really means, maybe if you could explain the relative power of these groups and how much it may matter, if it does matter. This article that I saw here about how the Svoboda Party is building a very close relationship with Germany's neo-Nazi NPD party. And the German Nazis, they approve very strongly of America's regime change over there in Ukraine. I was wondering if you could just talk about, I guess, maybe what you know about the regime change and how important is this? Is this what it looks like? Did I just say that the German Nazis are in on this with us now?
Well, there's obviously been a lot of reporting that it's true that one of the coalition parties in the interim Ukrainian government is neo-Nazi. It's a fascist party, and clearly they have connections with other fascist parties in Europe, just because that's the way these things work. So I mean, it's like, well, you remember all the denial that was going on about Al-Qaeda type terrorists being connected with the insurgency in Syria. I think we're seeing the same sort of thing, where obviously these groups who are organized, have money, have connections all across Europe, are a lot stronger than their numbers might indicate, and this is the horse we're backing. John McCain put his arm around the leader of the party when he made one of his notorious visits to Maidan Square. So it's the kind of things you get caught up in because you don't understand what's going on in these places, and these people are manipulating you. That's exactly what happens.
Yeah, you know, I saw where people are complaining, Ukrainians are complaining. They're like, hey, nobody really likes these guys. It's the American intervention and for example, the deal brokered by the European Union that really gave them enhanced power. And then I'm trying to remember who it was. It might have been in a comment section where somebody was saying everybody thinks that they can use the fascists to get their little dirty work done, but that it's not going to be a threat. But that's not how it usually works out in history, man. These guys are fanatical, and they've won themselves now, and I don't know how much popular support they really do have, but they've won something around the order of 8 major positions in the new government, including, I'm not exactly sure, but I think the Secretary of Defense and the head of the National Police and the top attorney general and all of this, right?
Yeah, they have serious leverage over the government, and they, as you say, they have 8 senior positions in the government, and so, you know, it's like, all right, we don't know what these guys represent. Maybe they're being misrepresented by the media too, but you know, it's one of these situations you don't know what's going on, and you're backing people because of some ideological agenda you have, and it's a recipe for disaster, and it's a recipe for disaster over and over again. And what makes this one particularly bad is the fact that the confrontation is with Russia, and Russia is a serious major military power. And you know, it's like, why are we seeing this? God.
Yeah. Well, it goes back to what you're saying about the conversation, especially among conservatives. There, you know, where you have a window into the conversation in Washington, D.C. I wonder. Is anyone, I mean, even John McCain said there are no military options here. I mean, come on, nukes are nukes, right? So, I mean, they realize there's some kind of limit, but they don't seem to realize where it is, right? They sure do seem to push too far. I mean, this latest push being the best example of that, and then they want to act surprised about Crimea, but they're not really.
Yeah, well, the thing is, you know, McCain and these others are saying there's no military option, because there is no military option. We don't have the resources in that part of the world to actually do anything militarily, and he knows that, and anybody who looks at the situation knows it. But they're quite willing to push Russia into a corner by every other means, sanctions, you know, declaring the Russian leaders to be war criminals, the whole baggage of things that they tend to do. They're quite willing to put Russia into a corner and expect that Russia's not going to react. I mean, that's what's so crazy about this. It's not, I don't expect nukes are going to be flying next week or anything like that, but the fact is that there are consequences every time you create these kinds of situations where you're putting somebody else on the defensive and you're increasing the pressure like we do with Iran. And their consequences are that you can't really get out of the box yourself. You're trapped in by your own rhetoric. You're trapped in by what you're doing to the other guy. And I think this is what's awful about these situations. Instead of sitting back and reasonably addressing the issues and talking about the issues, they just want to go ballistic every time.
Yeah. All right. Well, so what if Putin decided to really call the bluff and invade the Baltics? I mean, would they? I mean, those are already NATO members. Those countries are, or even, I guess, you could answer if you want about what if he invades East Ukraine or all of Ukraine. But what if he went ahead and called our bluff on NATO and Eastern Europe altogether and said, "Enough of this. You know, you want to defend Germany, fine, but you know, this part of Europe is our backyard, and your alliance is now null and void." What would they do then? Would that be a nuclear war, or would they back down, or what do you think?
Well, I think first of all, I don't think Putin has any kind of ambition like that. But the fact is that if that scenario were to play out, I think NATO would be obligated to defend the three countries there, and it could be nuclear war. And that's why this stuff is scary. It's real world scary that we pushed the borders of NATO right up to Russia. It would have been fine to, you know, bring these countries into the European Union, because that's essentially an economic union and a political union. But to push a military alliance up to the doorstep of a country that you had promised not to do this, it's crazy. All of this stuff has been crazy.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that guy Jack Matlock, the former ambassador, his piece in the Washington Post said America's been a bully this whole time, kicking them while they're down this whole time for 20 years. Instead of being a good sport about it, we whooped them in the Cold War. Their empire fell apart, and then we do nothing but persecute them and humiliate them and degrade them. And then we're, you know, and as you're saying, push right up to their borders and then act like, oh, no, history began the other day as soon as, you know, their troops left their bases on the Crimean Peninsula. And yeah. Never mind anything leading up to that.
The research I was just doing on this Ambassador McFaul, I mean, he met with opposition. As soon as he arrived in Moscow, he met with opposition politicians before he even presented his credentials at the foreign ministry. He was sending a signal that we're with the opposition. How does an ambassador from a major power do that to another major power and expect that there are no consequences? This kind of stuff is just, it is so crazy. Scott, I can't even believe it. I have a feeling like I'm just going to go crazy at some point because I don't understand this anymore.
It is. It's madness. I mean, even with John Kerry running the State Department, still, it's almost unbelievable that could be true. All right, well, hell, now we don't have that much time, but I want to ask you about Turkey because we talked before about how, yeah, you let them have democracy in Turkey. They elect conservative Islamists, and that's what Erdogan is. And the young and the high tech and the people that live in the city, they're, you know, the Turkish version of the Democrats, basically, and they may not like it and they may throw a big protest, but he really does have majority support. But then, things sure don't look like it on CNN nowadays. I don't know. What is going on?
Well, he's basically gone a little nuts. What's coming up is elections, local elections on Sunday, and the two biggest prizes are Ankara and Istanbul, and Istanbul is by far the biggest prize. It looks like his party is going to lose in Istanbul. Erdogan was mayor of Istanbul, so, you know, that's one of his bases of support, and it looks like he's going to lose it. That kind of changes everything in Turkey. It means that Erdogan will not be able to run for president in September, and it means that his party will be back on its heels. The guy is basically, you know, he's gone, in a way, crazy in terms of trying to suppress the opposition to him, which is every time he does something, it grows. He closed down Twitter a couple days ago. He's against the internet. He's done a lot of things that are making people very nervous about what he represents.
Picked a fight with Syria.
Yeah, and he shot down a Syrian plane that was inside Syria, apparently. But he's doing that as a diversion. And so the thing is, the guy shows the downside of electing people that you know, run basically on a religious agenda, because his support is essentially religious. His supporters are the peasants in the countryside who are deeply religious, but don't really think seriously about other issues. And, you know, how this will play out in Turkey, I don't know. The Turks are very tough, very hard-minded people, and this can go in a lot of different directions.
Well, so now what about the National Endowment for Democracy and or the CIA in Turkey? I mean, they would prefer the old secular military dictatorship to any kind of elected religious conservative like him, wouldn't they?
Yeah, they would. I don't think Ned is operating there because the Turks probably would not permit that. And having been in the CIA in that country, I could assure you that CIA is being very careful about what it does because the Turkish security services are very good.
So you don't think this is a color-coded revolution in a way here?
No, I don't think so. I don't think we have that kind of leverage, and I don't think that we're involved at that kind of level.
All right. They'd like to try, but they just don't figure they could get away with it, you think?
Yeah, I think that's probably the best way to put it.
All right. Well, now I'd save till we got no time whatsoever, hardly left, for you to address this, but did you see the five-part series by Patrick Coburn about the next generation of suicide bomber Al-Qaedaites in Libya, Syria, etc.? And what do you think of it? Overstated, understated, big deal?
I think it's overstated a bit because, you know, you got to tell a story. But the fact is, I think his facts are certainly credible insofar as I was aware of the background to them. And it was very, very good, very well done.
Yeah, well, that's really too bad. I really like his journalism, too. I think he does a great job. Unfortunately, that means what he writes is accurate and what he writes is horrible. But there you go.
Yeah,
all right,
I
thanks.
Know, exactly.
That's Phil Giraldi, everybody. Antiwar.com. Appreciate it. We're out of time.
Thanks, Scott.
See ya.
Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
All right, y'all, welcome. Back to the thing here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm out on Liberty Express Radio, etc., etc., etc. Also, you can find me at ScottHorton.org. That's where I keep all my audio archives and the rest of it. All right. So now it is, I think it's part eight. Yes, part eight of our interview series with Gareth Porter, independent historian and journalist Gareth Porter from Interpress Service and TruthOut.org. And this piece is, the book is Manufactured Crisis. The untold, you see how many times I've interviewed Gareth? I got the whole thing just on, wrote, you know, this piece as though it's a new article, even though I'm staring with my eyeballs directly at the book in front of me. The book is Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare, and it's got a big, stinking, ugly Benjamin Netanyahu on the front, and it's for sale at your local book website and or brick-and-mortar bookstore. Welcome back to the show. Gareth, appreciate you joining us again.
Thanks for having me back, Scott.
Very happy to have you here. Part 8, I think it's Chapter 9, Manufactured Crisis, again, is the title of the book. No, it's Chapter 7, Intelligence Failure. And you know, this was a known unknown to me. Something that I've always wondered, always wanted a hell of a lot more background on. And you know, I've read everything you ever wrote about this before. But this is exactly what I wanted to know, was what the hell is going on at the CIA this whole time while they're, you know, at least somewhat lying us into this conflict with Iran over their alleged nuclear weapons program. You know, we get to see the results and even the footnotes sometimes on the declassified version of this and that. But what the hell is the story about what was really going on there? And you've really done a great bit here in Chapter 7 at talking with Paul Pilar and Thomas Fingar and some of these other people inside the CIA about their massive intelligence failure on the Iran issue, and really helped clarify a lot of things for me. So I was really glad to see that. And, well, the whole book is just great.
You're one hell of a great journalist. Thanks so much, Scott. Well, I think that this this chapter really is something that nobody else has really thought about very much. I think it's safe to say that is to say the failure of U.S. The intelligence community to really get Iran right from the beginning. I mean, they have just been, they started out getting it wrong, and then it just got worse and worse. And I mean, it really is a question of sort of building on your past mistakes. You know, I mean, it's layer upon layer of assessments on Iran that have been made over the years that simply repeated and worsened, sort of dug a deeper hole, if you will, about the Iranian nuclear program. And I think I've talked about this. I know I've talked about this before in your program. What started it was this business of the telexes, mm-hmm. the interception of hundreds of telexes that the people who were looking at them said, oh, boy, we've got them now, because they saw these, they saw these requests from Sharif University for technology and material that could be used possibly for a nuclear program, and they thought they saw the telex number of an outfit that was connected with the Defense Ministry of Iran, and therefore they put it together and they concluded that the Iranian military had its own secret nuclear program, which of course was for the purpose of getting nuclear weapons, mm-hmm. and they failed to really consider the alternative, which was far more plausible, which turned out to be the case, that this handful of telexes that had to do with things that were dual use, quote unquote, were in fact for Sharif University professors and their students, all of which was documented later on mm-hmm. by the Iranians to the satisfaction of the IAEA in November or I guess it was early 2008 when it was published in the IAEA report. It was all there in black and white how essentially there was a perfectly innocent explanation for every one of those cases. And
well, so now let me ask you then. I mean, it seems like, and we've talked about the telexes before, and it seems like, okay, if I'm just using my imagination about, you know, Ray McGovern, another nice guy, CIA analysts up there doing their best or something like that, right? I could yeah. see why they would say something like, okay, let's pretend for a minute in this, you know, blue folder, we'll start with the assumption that, oh, yeah, this definitely means something. And we'll work from there. And, okay, it's kind of inductive and backwards thinking, but at least we'll see if we can really build a case and we'll try to test our hypothesis, but without necessarily being married to all the assumptions in the blue folder over here. But still, it's worth being suspicious. It's worth, you know, going ahead and really taking the time and making sure we're wrong then, something like that. But what you're telling me is they start with the assumption, they get married to exactly whatever they think it is in there. But then are you further saying that they should have known, not just after the Iranians fessed up every last little detail of what was really going on to the IAEA years later, but they should have known all along that they were, you know, simply just connecting four where they didn't really belong?
Yeah. It should have been nothing more than a hypothesis that would guide, you know, the look for evidence, nothing more than that, under the circumstances. But it wasn't. They did get married to the notion that that this was evidence of Iranian nuclear intent during the 1990s. And the reason that that happened, and this is, I think, the real contribution of this part of the book, what I show is that there was a fundamental problem here of incentives, which was created by the knowledge that senior officials at the CIA, i.e. Robert M. Gates, who had become CIA director in late 1991, and the people at the Defense Department, all those people had a stake in showing that Iran was a threat to get nuclear weapons. And I've mentioned this again before, but what the significance of that is that these people who were analysts knew that they were expected, their job was to come up with evidence to show that Iran was a nuclear threat, a threat to get nuclear weapons. And, I mean, it was never stated explicitly that that was the case, but I just point out in the chapter that that there was a new center created just around that time that had the job of providing the evidence to the policymakers so that they can make policy on this new threat of nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction proliferation. So I mean, it didn't take a genius to see that there would be an effect on the expectations of the policymakers. Was going to have a very strong effect on how the ambiguous, inherently ambiguous evidence was going to be interpreted by the analysts. And that pattern continued year after year forever since, essentially, because the policy has hardened over time that the accusation that Iran wants to get nuclear weapons became more and more entrenched in the official declaratory policy of the United States, particularly after the Clinton administration came into power. And so the analysts were clearly under a very subtle form of, I don't want to call it pressure, but incentives. It was positive incentives. They knew that their careers would be rewarded. They'd be rewarded. Their careers would benefit from being able to come up with the evidence that they understood the policymakers wanted. Mm-hmm. And I also show that this is exactly the problem that caused the massive intelligence failure on Iraq. That's why you had a 2002 Iraq WMD and National Intelligence Estimate that just went completely off the rails. Because these people knew that the policymakers expected evidence to support their policy. And, you know, to some extent, you know, that was Vice President Dick Cheney going over to the CIA and kind of putting pressure on them very clearly. But in addition to that, I mean, just in a larger sense, there was a constant drumbeat of statements indicating that we know that Iran has nuclear weapons or is after nuclear weapons. And I'm sorry, we're now talking about Iraq. So going back to Iraq, we know that Iraq wants nuclear weapons, and so the assumption came to be in the intelligence community that yes, we know that Iraq wants nuclear weapons, and therefore the evidence was interpreted precisely in that way. And the Rob Silverman Commission, which examined the failure of intelligence on Iraq, points this out very clearly. This is a major contribution to understanding about what happened in the case of Iraq. That is not well known, but I talk about it at some length in my book, and I see the failure on Iran precisely paralleling that failure on Iraq.
Wait a minute. I mean, this almost sounds just, you know, as simple as, yeah, come on. Everybody knows that the CIA exists to tell whatever lies the government needs it to tell or to kill whoever it's supposed to kill, and the idea that they're really after objective analysis or anything just sort of sounds silly at this point. If the CIA, especially the way you describe it, if anyone at the CIA, the director, the deputy director, or anybody in charge of the thing over there really wanted the truth, they would have an entire room full of guys whose entire job was simply to argue with the other guys and try to debunk them. But they're not doing that. They're simply trying to prove Dick Cheney right, because that's their job.
Well, you're right. You know, Scott, I mean, the fact is that intelligence is always politicized in some sense. Sometimes far more subtly and to a lesser degree than other times. And what I'm talking about here, I think, is a case which is an extreme sort of example, or not an extreme example. It's a case which is far more influenced by politics than the normal. Even the norm is the normal situation is that politics intrudes in some way, and this is an exacerbation of that normal situation is what I'm trying to argue.
Right. Well, yeah, and I think it's important, too, that, you know, the much less cynical take is really obviously the more accurate one and also the more acceptable to regular people, too, that, okay, yes, Doug Feith might have lied us into war, but not everybody at CIA lied us into war. They lied themselves into war. That was their job, was believing this stuff, and so they did their job. It was much less subtle than really being liars in the simplest sense. But anyway, I'm sorry we got to take this break. We'll be right back with the great Gareth Porter. The book is Manufactured Crisis. On March 7th at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., the Council for the National Interest is co-hosting the first ever national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Confirmed speakers include Walt Scheuer, Giraldi, McGovern, Katowski, Porter, McConnell, Weiss, Raimondo, USS Liberty survivor Ernie Gallo, as well as co-sponsors Alison Ware of If Americans Knew and the great Grant Smith of the Institute for Research, Middle East Policy. That's the national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Friday, March the 7th, all day at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. NatSummit.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with the great Gareth Porter, author of the new book, Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. And just in time, too, we're in this intermediate period before the final Iran deal, if it ever is truly negotiated by sometime early next summer, they say, this coming summer. So, we're talking about Chapter 7, intelligence failure here, and all the incentives is sort of like the old pincher strategy, right? You've got politicians like Newt Gingrich and Scooter Libby and Dick Cheney coming over to CIA saying, hey, where's all your stuff on Iraq, man? Let's see some dirt here. And so then that becomes, you know, basically the profession of the CIA is coming up with stuff for Scooter to use, and they start doing that job.
Well, and then you know, also, at its worst, you had a case where the part of the CIA that was supposed to be the specialist on weapons and proliferation was actually declaring at a meeting of the staff that the White House wants its war, and our job is to make the case for them.
Yeah. That was when you say Alan Bolton Foley. Took them all out to dinner and yeah. made friends with them all, and you guys are part of our little neocon crew. Honorary members for a little while, anyway.
Let me just add one other point lest people get the idea that everybody in the CIA and the intelligence community was equally sucked in to this system, because people should understand that there were honest analysts like Paul Pillar, for one, who I interviewed on several occasions for this book, who were taking a different viewpoint, who were trying to suggest that it was much more complex, that in fact there was no real reason to believe that Iran had made a decision to go for nuclear weapons, and that, you know, if they ever did, it would be because of circumstances changing, and the United States had something to say about those circumstances, so let's kind of relax a little bit. I mean, those are my words, of course. But, I mean, Pillar and other people who were the regional specialists, rather than the proliferation specialists and the weapons specialists, had a very different slant, a different way of looking at this issue, and there was a continuing dialogue, at least from 2001 on, between those people and the weapons and proliferation specialists. So, you know, the part of the story is how the weapons and proliferation specialists prevailed in their view, which was, you know, don't give us this stuff about they haven't decided yet. We know they have. And basically, just on the basis of inference. And Paul Pillar points out that all of these assessments from 2001, 2005, which said that Iran has a nuclear weapons program, it was all on inference. There was no real solid evidence.
Oh, yeah. And then my favorite quote, well, I don't know, out of the whole book, certainly out of this chapter, is sacred text. Any previous national intelligence estimate, man, you don't go back and challenge those assumptions. We don't have time for all this. We move forward from here. And yet, it doesn't matter. In other words, it doesn't matter how wrong the previous NIE is, to ask them to challenge the assumptions in it is virtually unheard of.
Yeah, and I mean, this is extremely important, because that was precisely what was happening in 2007, when the final, you know, not the final, but the big national intelligence estimate that everybody is aware of, in November 2007, basically reaffirmed most of what had been said in past national intelligence estimates about the Iranian nuclear program. Basically, they were concluding, yeah, the Iranians want nuclear weapons, just like they always had. And they were doing so not because they really, you know, had such new convincing evidence, but because they were simply relying on the idea that they were right in the past. And in many cases, it's the same people. I mean, they were relying on the same offices, the same people who had been putting forward that that inference, not the evidence, but the inference in the past. And also, I have to add, they were relying on the same old damn documents that we've been talking about all along. That is to say, the documents that were turned over to Western intelligence by the Mujahideen calc.
Right.
They believed that they were authentic, or at least they accepted that, whether they believed it or not. That was the premise of the decisions, the judgments that were made in the November 2007 estimate. And I conclude that that estimate's been misunderstood, both by the supporters and the opponents. The opponent saying it's a terrible thing because, you know, it took away the military option, and the supporters because it took away the military option. But in the process, I think it made a serious error when it said that it showed that that they had evidence that Iran had a nuclear weapons program. I don't think it's evidence of a nuclear weapons program. I think it was evidence that somebody was doing some work that related to nuclear weapons. And the indication, all of the circumstantial evidence and even more direct evidence indicates that this was not a government program. This was people who were operating outside the framework of government policy.
Well, now, are you sure about that, or it was just covert, maybe?
Well, I think it was covert. And in fact, I think, you know, I have evidence in the book that the Supreme Leader, according to one of his advisors, who's the conservative editor of Kahan newspaper, told a U.S. reporter, Robert Collier of San Francisco Chronicle, in October 2003, that the people who had been working on nuclear weapons, doing research that related to nuclear weapons, were being stigmatized for doing so covertly by the Supreme Leader, who had made a speech saying, you know, nuclear weapons are are illegal under Islam. It was not the first time he'd said it, but the timing of this was at the same time that Hassan Rouhani, who was in charge of the nuclear file, sent out a circular to all government offices and wanted to know, okay, what has been done by your office on anything relating to nuclear, and if it hasn't been authorized, then it has to cease. And so, that was what was being objected to.
So, in other words, just to make sure I got this right, because I couldn't tell you how many times I've heard people say otherwise about this.
This is almost absolute holy text on this issue.
They always say, the NIE of 07. In fact, I saw some sophisticated critics saying, aha, this is actually propaganda. They're giving us a little bit, but they're actually still lying, saying that there was a program up through 03. And really, as you describe in this chapter, no, it was just the bureaucratic fight and the compromise that ended up going with the previous assumptions. Then even after they decided that they said that there's not a nuclear weapons program and there hadn't been since 03. But you're saying, first of all, we can dispense with that, it was the bureaucratic compromise is what made it say what it said. But you're telling me that the intelligence behind they did have some kind of program up until 03. The evidence that they ever had any program, it's just the telexes and a smoking laptop and the rest of this nonsense that we've already discussed.
What
made the CIA decide that whatever it was no longer ongoing was the cancellation of some rogue projects that never amounted to anything in the first place. And that was where they sort of got it half right and good enough to slow Bush down on his bombing campaign right?
But they had very, very weak evidence. I think that is the bottom line from my point of view. What they had was maybe a couple of people who were complaining that they were shut down or something was shut down. And believe me, I mean, we have no reason to believe at this point that they had anything more than something that they inferred meant that there was a nuclear weapons program. Nothing more than that. And given the degree to which the inference had been made that Iran had a nuclear weapons program for years and years based on nothing, there's absolutely no reason to believe that they had anything more than something that could have been interpreted and should have been interpreted otherwise.
Oh, whoops, sorry. Damn, my
still there?
Off. I do that sometimes, you know. All right, so now, and I'm sorry because we're almost out of time here, but tell me all about John Doe. This is an important story.
Yes.
Who's this and how do you know?
Very quickly, this is a story that has been misreported or only partially reported, I guess is a better way to put it, in the newspapers, in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and elsewhere. It was an undercover agent for the CIA who developed a very high-value source in Iran in 2001 and who was told by his high-value source that the Iranian government has no intention of weaponizing. He passed it on to his bosses at the CIA. They did not want that to go out to the analysts or anybody else in the U.S. government. And they told him that they would personally brief the president. Now, that indicates, of course, that this was regarded as extremely sensitive and would obviously affect U.S. policy. And it's clear that there were very powerful interests in the CIA and in the Bush administration who did not want that information to go out.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then you talk about how Operation Merlin and I don't know if we need to go over all of that. I guess you can tell it real fast if you could. In a nutshell, the CIA accidentally, on purpose, sort of kind of gave some nuclear weapons blueprints to the Iranians on the assumption that they'll try to use it and make their bomb, but there'll be flawed blueprints and the rest of this. People can read about that, but you're saying then part of the cover-up was, we can't admit that we would take such a risk over a nuclear weapons program that never existed. So that was why, one of the main reasons that they had to bury this guy's info.
It was the very people who were in charge of that program who were part of I call it a conspiracy, to suppress this vitally important intelligence. I'm sure that they never told President George Bush. That's what the undercover CIA agent told his lawyer. and said so. Sorry, he didn't just tell his lawyer. Said so in a court filing when he actually sued the CIA for having basically fired him. And so you know, this is a major move to suppress intelligence that would have conflicted with the dominant viewpoint and the viewpoint that these powerful interests wanted to make sure would remain as the CIA's position.
And that's why you all ought to buy Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. It's just great, man. You got to read this thing. Thank you so much for your time, Gareth.
Thanks for having me on again.
Appreciate it. We're going to wrap up here in a day or two, I promise. All right, see y'all tomorrow. Thanks again for listening.